Voilà so. So what shall we do? A couple of people asked me whether I'd be willing to give some instruction on Vipassana before we all disband. I thought that might be a good idea. So I thought about different approaches. There are so many different avenues of Vipassana. But then as soon as I came to this following idea, then I would just immediately say, oh, that's definitely the right one. And so what I'll share with you, and I'm not quite sure how many days this will take. It certainly won't take beyond Saturday. It may just take 3 days. We'll just play it by ear. But what I'd like to share with you will be the oral transmission and explanation for Padmasambhava's teachings on Vipassana in his text, Natural Liberation. And we're already familiar with part of that text because really the whole practice of awareness that we focused on is almost entirely derived from his teachings. And so immediately following his explanation of awareness, achieving shamatha by that means, description of what it's like to have achieved shamatha, then the very next chapter is on Vipassana. And it's very, very concise. And so what I've extracted in the notes that I've printed out here, that I'll share with you, are within that chapter on Vipassana, just his meditative instructions themselves. There's a bit more to the chapter than that, and that is there's some background information. There are then, right towards the end, after he's given his core meditation instructions, then there are some citations from various sources, just kind of showing the deep context. So we see this theme of giving instructions, but always being in dialogue with earlier and even more authoritative sources. This has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years, so I'm not doing anything original in that regard. And so what I've extracted from the chapter, which includes his core instructions, a little bit of background material, and then citations from other sources, Dzogchen Tantras and so forth, I've just pulled out of that what turns out to be just about exactly 3 pages, single-spaced, of his core instructions on Vipassana. Just by the way, what follows this section, this is in the 6 bardos, what follows this is then his core instructions on dream yoga. But we won't have time for that. So we'll just focus on Vipassana. And so I received this, the oral transmission, the teachings, the commentary on the entire text, Natural Liberation, Padmasambhava's teachings on the 6 bardos, from Gyatro Rinpoche in the late 90s. And then I translated the text and his commentary under his close guidance, and he's authorized me to teach the entire text. And certainly this portion of the text can be received by anyone, people listening by way of podcast and so on. So I'll pass on this transmission. I find it, of course, I find it utterly marvelous, very utterly to the point. But it's good to know the context. The context is he's just finished his presentation on shamatha, and he goes through a variety of different methods, starting from something really coarse, coarser than what we've done, and that is placing something like a flower in front of you, and then just see if you can stay focused on the flower. So he starts out really coarse, a flower, a stick, or a stone, and they just focus. Right? That's not too hard. And then he goes subtler and subtler and subtler until finally, having covered a whole array from coarse to subtle of shamatha methods with a sign, which means with an object that you focus on, then he goes to shamatha without a sign, which of course is awareness. Immediately following that, his teachings on Vipassana, immediately following that, dream yoga, and then the text proceeds from there. And it is a complete text, the whole path to enlightenment, rainbow body, it's all in this one text. So if you're interested in the richer context, his background, and then also Gyatro Rinpoche's oral commentary, which is transcribed, I translated, it was transcribed and we edited it, then I suggest buy the book. It's published by Wisdom Publications and it's called Natural Liberation. So how does he begin his teachings then on Vipassana? This short discussion, and you'll get the whole discussion is here, all of his meditative instructions on 3 pages. So that's, as I said, very quintessential. The whole instruction is comprised of 3 sections. First one is revealing the nature of awareness. Secondly, engaging in the search for the mind. And thirdly, identifying pristine awareness. So we'll cover those three, assuming we're all alive all the way through. If I die, then you're out of luck. Okay, so we start with revealing the nature of awareness. So now I think the context is quite clear, yeah? So in that way, he's referring to the preceding discussion, shamatha without a sign. Until genuine shamatha arises in your mind stream, use numerous techniques to settle your mind in its natural state. So again, like Lerap Lingba's complete account of settling the mind in its natural state, where every single sentence is just pithy, this is the same. So in that way, as he described earlier, until shamatha fully arises, genuine shamatha arises in your mind stream, use numerous techniques, he said. So this is the lineage of Padmasambhava. And that is, you don't have to just stick with one and then just stick with it tenaciously until you achieve it. You can, as he's suggesting right here, this is a very direct translation under the guidance of my Lama. I think you can count on it. It's not an interpretation, it's a translation. That you can really avail yourselves of a certain variety of methods. And I've chosen three, and I think a number of you already, perhaps all of you for that matter, are now skillfully using one, two, or three of the methods and just recognizing, how is your mind today? How wakeful are you? I was just reading Yatra Rinpoche's commentary on the shamatha without a sign, and he referred to meditating in the supine position, lying down. And he said, that's not so good if you're prone to dullness and laxity. Then you should be sitting up. But that's all. So there it is, but we know that. You go into the supine, you want to go more and more relaxed, but without losing clarity. If you do lose clarity, then go for a walk, sit up in meditation, look at bright lights, drink some cold water, do something, but there's just no point in doing the facsimile of meditating and just getting dopey and drowsy. But that was his only comment. He didn't say, only if you're a California hippie can you go and meditate in the supine position. No, he didn't say that. And so it really is quite okay. So that it used numerous techniques to settle your mind in its natural state. So now, isn't it wonderful that we're reading this now that you've had 7 weeks of really solid shamatha practice behind you? So when he says settle your mind in its natural state, you know exactly what he's talking about. It doesn't need any explanation, right? If it does, I'm very sad. As an analogy, if you wish to look at reflections and the planets and stars in a pool of water, They will not be seen where the water is disturbed by waves and ripples. Such an interesting analogy. Just gazing into a still pool of water, of course, you can be seeing all kinds of things there. If there are trees on the far side, you may see reflections of the trees. You may look at the clouds, reflections of clouds. Or if it's at nighttime, you may look in and you may see quite clearly the reflections of planets and stars in the pool of water. But not if the water is disturbed by waves and ripples. So, very nice analogy. It's a really deep analogy, actually. But they are clearly seen by looking into a pool in which the water is limpid and unmoving. So, of course, if it's all muddy, if it's just covered with silt or moss and so forth and so on, even if it's very still, that's not going to work. So it has to be very crystal clear water, and it has to be still. Does that ring any bells? Stillness, stability, limpidity, clarity, you know. It's a cool, cool metaphor. Likewise, when the mind is jolted around, pushed around, by the wind of objects. So now you might know where the kiting into the wind comes from. You kite into the wind, but you're not jolted around it by it. You're just riding the wind. Again, so much like a surfer also, just riding the wave and not just thrown around by the wave, right? So when the mind is jolted around by the wind of objects, or like a rider on a bucking bronco. So now you know where that metaphor came from. Padmasambhava, again, they had bucking broncos in Tibet. Okay, when that happens, even if you are introduced to awareness, you do not identify it. And he's really primarily referring here to pristine awareness. You can go for, you know, you can find some lama. In Tibet it was the case. Nowadays it's the case. You may find a lama, maybe phony baloney lama, maybe an authentic lama. But you might find one that says, I give pointing out instructions on Rigpa. Come on, Kanal, it costs you $500 for the weekend, you know, pointing out instructions. Maybe an authentic lama. The fact that they're charging does not mean it's inauthentic. They have to charge, pay for their bills and all of that, expenses. Or maybe somebody who just knows how to talk the talk and has found a nice way to make a living. It's difficult to tell. But nowadays it's not that difficult. Not that difficult to find someone who's saying, I will give pointing out instructions. I will give you mind-to-mind transmission of Rigpa, pristine awareness. Cool. But if your mind is jolted around by the wind of objects, or your mind is like a rider on a bucking bronco, even if you are introduced to, you receive the pointing out instructions, you do not identify it. Something may be given, maybe it's only falsely given, they're just giving the words, but you don't get it. You don't really get it. You do not identify it. For once the mind is helplessly manipulated by compulsive ideation, it does not see its own nature. So that just is enormously important. Right? To take the step by step. I mean, on the one hand, it makes really good sense to be introduced to a wide variety of teachings. Poa teachings and state regeneration teachings and shamatha and vipassana and lamrim and vajrasattva and yukne and all kinds of teachings. Get a big panoramic vision. Get the big picture. That's good. That's good. But if that's all one does then, and the rest of one's life, one goes off and does a little weekend here of shamatha, and then a little weekend here of dzogchen, a bit of a weekend here of chenrei zi, and then a week long of vajrasattva, and then this and this, and you get older and older and older, all you wind up with is a nice big picture. So I was given really quintessential advice a long time ago, and of course by multiple lamas, but I remember it especially from Geshe Rabten. And because I was his principal interpreter for years, close student for all the 70s. And he said, you know, when you're really setting out on the path, recognize those practices that are designed for where you are right now. That you can do them. They benefit you. It's not simply faith. You derive benefit. You see the transformation, the purification. You find genuine happiness coming. They're really working. Find those practices and focus primarily on those that really transform your mind. Right? Whether it's developing renunciation, whether it's shamatha, whether it's four measurables, bodhicitta, realization of emptiness, whatever it is, but find where you are and then focus on those. And in the meantime, there's a type of meditation that's called shargom in Tibetan. And shar just literally means to arise. It's sometimes translated as glancing meditation or scanning meditation, something like that. And that is where, for example, in lamrim, people who are well-trained in lamrim, if you're really going through that methodically, step by step, developing your renunciation, your bodhicitta, and so forth, and not skipping shamatha, shame on them when they skip shamatha, if you're going through that, then you may be focusing primarily for some time, weeks or months, on just meditating on the nature of your own existence, having a human life of leisure and opportunity, a precious human life, okay? Fantastic meditation. Transformative meditation, revolutionary meditation. And he says, all right, if you're really going for the lamrim, to proceed along that path, then meditate on this until you've completely internalized it. And so you focus primarily on that, but you do the shargom. You'll find some text, and there are many of them, short texts that you can just whip through and you can read through them in 5 minutes, in 10 minutes, that covers the whole path, right? And then just touch the points, just lightly touch the points. And so it's like a bee just going from flower to flower to flower. But saturate your mind here until you've drunk it. You've drunk it fully. And then you move on to the next one. You really meditate deeply on impermanence, the nature of mortality, and so forth, until you totally get it. It's now shifted your way of viewing reality. There's not a whole lot to learn in the meditation on impermanence. Do you really think you're not going to die? Do you think that really you've got guarantee that you're going to live for a certain number of decades? You know, that's not a whole lot of learning there. But to so incorporate, so internalize the meditation that you're just viewing every situation through this vision of everything is impermanent. All my relationships, activities, my health, everything, all of this in a constant soul of impermanence. Death could come at any day. Death will absolutely come. And in the face of death, there is only one thing of value, and that's Dharma. And nothing else. That's big. That's powerful. In the face of Dharma, when in the face of death, when you're on your deathbed, you can reach out and touch death and touch him on the nose. The Lord of Death, hi, we're just about to meet. And just puck him on the nose. That's how close you are. In that perspective, there's only one thing of value. Either there's nothing of value, and that's if you're a materialist, there's nothing of value. You're about to become obliterated. So whatever is the value is past tense. If you're a materialist, value time is finished. That's it. I mean, you're really just facing completely non-value time. And then termination of everything, including termination of all values. Because there's nothing. Nothing means no value. But in Dharma, there is something. There's one thing, and that's Dharma. And so, realizing that. So the point here is you move step by step through the Lam Rim, and this comes in many, many guises in the Sakya tradition, the Nyingma tradition, and so forth. But it's really transforming, revolutionizing one's whole perspective on reality. And so you focus in on where you are until it just saturates and your view is shifted. And then you bring your magnifying glass and focus in. But meanwhile, you're scanning ahead. And so you're sowing the seeds for the later stages, including maybe stage of generation, stage of completion, right? All the way up to enlightenment itself. You scan through those. So step by step, you're already stepping into somewhat familiar ground. But you're not just scanning through the whole thing all the time and then never going to depth in any of them. And I think that's a really great danger of a lot of what I see taking place now. And in a way, it's not anybody's fault. I mean, the lamas are so, qualified lamas are so widely distributed in Australia and South America and Europe and North America and Mexico and so forth, that pretty much what I've seen happening a lot is there'll be a Dharma center, and you'll hear such and such Rinpoche is coming and he's giving these initiations. And let's go get those initiations. And we all sit down and get the initiations. And the lama's gone. And then it's, feast or famine. And then the lama's coming. He's gonna teach this. What's he teaching? Oh, that's what he's teaching. Okay. And then, and we get a little bit of this, but there's no coordination. There's no mastermind by and large. I mean, just the lama's showing up. And I know all kinds of centers like this. I've lived in centers like this. So you get a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and after a while you've got a whole bunch of stuff and you've received, hundreds of empowerments perhaps, and you say, what do I do? So this is what Padmasambhava is getting back, and this is the path. Focus in where you are. Transform your mind while looking ahead, sowing the seeds ahead. So enough said. Hola, so. But here's what he's saying. And that is before, and he can't say it any more clearly, but actually maybe he will say it even a bit more clearly, that before venturing into Vipassana, let alone receiving pointed out instructions and Dzogchen and Mahamudra and so forth and so on, getting your mind so serviceable, getting your mind so it's not like your awareness and not like a rider on a bucking bronco just being thrown off your horse all the time, jolted around by just one obsessive flow of thoughts after another. It's just a useless, cruddy mind. And so get your mind in shape, for heaven's sakes. According to the custom of some teaching traditions, you are first introduced to the view. So according to some teaching traditions, you may have months or years of scholarly training. Learning one text after another, maybe memorizing the text, maybe debating the text, and you have one text maybe on the whole path to enlightenment, another text on Buddhist epistemology, and another text on Buddhist ontology, middle way, another text on Buddhist ethics and monastic discipline, and another text on Buddhist phenomenology, and then another text on stage regeneration, and you want one degree after another, and you learn the big picture, you become a real Buddhist scholar. And after doing that for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, 35, 40 years, then you meditate. Right? If you're still motivated. That's one approach. And it's very, very common nowadays. Very, very common. Very common. In all the traditions. Sakya. Sakya geshe study for years before they get their degree. Kempos. in the Nyingma tradition, Gagyu tradition, study for 10, 12 years, get their degree, and then maybe do some really serious meditation. Golupas, maybe 20 years, 30 years, and then maybe get to meditation. Eh, maybe not. And so he says, according to some, that's what they do. First, they really get introduced to the view, and then upon that basis, they seek the meditative state. And the meditative state is getting your mind serviceable, settling the mind in its natural state. It's shamatha. So there are some who do that. They'll study for years and years and years, and then maybe get around to shamatha, or maybe not. Maybe they just go off and teach what they've learned. So it's like receiving a whole bunch of baggage from one person, and then saying, here, thank you, Hagai, for the two big pieces of baggage. Bang, would you like some baggage? And then Bang says, oh, thank you. How long does that take to receive? 5 years. Okay. And then Bang says, thank you very much. And then he passes it on to Graham. Thank you. And everybody's packing on baggage full of clothes that they never wear. That's kind of odd. So according to some, you're first introduced to the view, and upon the basis of that, you seek the meditative state. This makes it difficult to identify awareness. It's Padmasambhava. That's not an interpretation. That's just Padmasambhava. This makes it difficult to identify pristine awareness, to really get Rigpa. Your mind becomes so inundated by all the things you've learned, and if you learn it well, you can easily fall into the mistake of thinking you actually know it. Whereas what you have is understanding. You don't have any realization, and let alone any confidence. But you become very articulate, and you can really spin a good yarn. It's easy to do. This makes it difficult to identify awareness. In this tradition, Padmasambhava is saying, in this tradition, you first establish the meditative state. And there's only one way to interpret that. It's settling the mind in its natural state through the achievement of genuine shamatha. You first establish the meditative state. Then on that basis, you're introduced to the view. And this whole text being a Dzogchen view, he's really referring to Dzogchen view. This profound point makes it impossible for you not to identify awareness. Therefore, first settle your mind in its natural state. Then bring forth genuine shamatha in your mind stream and reveal the nature of awareness. So, I don't know how I can possibly say it more clearly than that. So as you can tell, I'm pretty enthusiastic about this. I think generally it's just a superb approach. But especially in our modern context, where we are positioned in modernity, this whole phase of human civilization is such an anomaly. It's so weird. It's really so weird. Because in some ways, modernity, and it's China, and it's Brazil, and America, and Europe, and so forth, Australia, in some ways so sophisticated. So much intelligence, so much fine critical thinking, precision thinking, rigorous thinking. In some ways, so advanced, you know. And especially in the one area over the last 400 years where there's unequivocally and undeniably been tremendous progress. And I would say only in one area that is really, really clear. That is, in terms of modernity as a whole. And that's science and technology. I mean, this is just much better than the phones that I was raised with. You know, there's just no way that this is not better than click 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 click. You know, it's a lot better. And so, the amount of knowledge, people sometimes say that scientists learn more in the 20th century about the nature of the natural world than in all preceding centuries. They're probably right. In terms of advances in technology, probably more in the 20th century than in all the preceding centuries combined. Probably right. Right. And wouldn't it have been wonderful if also during that same century we made similar strides in developing compassion and deepening our sense of ethics and virtues altogether. And there was similar progress in cultivating, revealing, teaching, manifesting genuine happiness. Wouldn't that be fantastic? And that, boy, did that not happen. It was the most gruesome century in the history of humanity in some very significant ways. Mao Zedong killed 60 million people, of his own people. 60 million by the latest accounts. Stalin, 20 million. The Nazis, who knows how many? 10, 15 million. How many? 20. Another 20. It's so easy to say 15, 20. It's just as easy to say 20 as 10. But it's 20 million people. My God. And that's just Hitler. That's not his next door neighbor, Stalin, with his 20 million. And then Mao Zedong in the 50s, his great leaps forward into hell, you know, 60 million people. And that's not counting all the minor skirmishes, you know, and the desecration of the environment and so forth. And so, tremendous anomaly here. And so, on the one hand, this tremendous surge of increase of power. I mean, we can kill each other with so much more efficiency now than we ever imagined possible, like in the 19th century. And yet, advances in medicine and in astronomy and biology and medicine and neuroscience and so forth, fantastic strides. And it's all been in the objective, the physical, and the quantifiable. All of it has been there and there alone. And then one might wonder, what about, instead of the objective, the subjective, instead of the quantifiable, the qualitative, instead of the physical, the non-physical, what about that realm of reality? And so this is not just kind of leaping off into some wild tangent like, you know, my pet theme. It is a pet theme. But I think there's something very interesting here and very provocative, and that is, until Galileo, there were multiple theories about the nature of our Earth, our planet, and its place in the cosmos at large. The Ptolemy within Eurocentric societies, Europeans, really Europe at that point, it was utterly dominated by the Ptolemaic system, and I think he was second century of the Common Era, so it was a long time to be dominant. So astrology was built on him, astronomy was built on him, Earth is in the center, these concentric rings going out, out, out. It lasted, it dominated, it was simply considered to be the truth, the uncontestable truth, for centuries. I mean, many centuries. Copernicus came up in the 16th century with an alternative idea, but it was purely a mathematical theory, and it didn't really account for the appearances any better than Ptolemaic. It didn't have the epicycles, it didn't have the eccentrics, but when the Roman Catholic Church looked at it and other intellectuals, their conclusion was, that's very elegant mathematics. Because we don't really need to take it seriously. It simply accounts for the appearances in another way. And so he wasn't really in any major danger. He wouldn't let his work be published until after he is dead, because he was terrified of the Inquisition. But in fact, the church was pretty benign about that as a mathematical theory. And it was debated among the monks and priests and so forth, like philosophers debate. And then Galileo comes along almost exactly 400 years ago. And this is where this is relevant to this passage of the text. And you'll recall that what he introduced into this natural philosophy, because that's what they all regarded themselves as, Copernicus, Kepler, Newton, all of these people, right until the 19th century, the scientists didn't call themselves scientists, they called themselves natural philosophers. They were philosophers. Philosophers of what? Philosophers of nature. There are also philosophers of ethics and so forth and so on, but they were philosophers of nature. And so Galileo was one more, but what he introduced into this natural philosophy that was unprecedented and without parallel was, when it came to astronomy, he introduced the telescope. And the telescope needed to be mounted firmly with stability, and the lenses had to be well polished and well focused, clear, free of grime and dirt and so forth, so there'd be a lot of, vividness? I think that's the word. A clarity, acuity, something, so stability and acuity. We've been around for a while, haven't we? Yeah, 7 weeks shows its mark. And so he used that, and then he made discoveries that really no one in his right mind could deny, because all you had to do was put your eye to the eyepiece, and you would see what he saw. And so, yes, Jupiter has moons, and yes, the sun has spots, and yes, the moon has craters, and yes, and this is the most startling one, Venus has phases, which means Ptolemy was wrong. There is no way the Ptolemaic system can be true if Venus has phases, and anybody who looked at the telescope for a sustained period, you can't take a snapshot, but through a sustained period, you can see it has phases, like the moon has phases, and there's no way that Venus can have phases if Earth is in the center and everything else moves around. It's just no way. It's not possible. Therefore, Galileo empirically refuted a theory that had been unquestioned for many, many centuries. About 14. Twice as long as the whole history of science. More than twice as long as the whole history of science. Almost three times as long. More than three times as long, 1,400 years. And science is only 400 years. So more than 300 years, more than 300 times the whole history of science, an unquestioned assumption of the way to view the universe. He knocked it off by looking through a 30-power telescope. Because that's as good as he got, you know. But then as soon as he saw it, anybody who looks at it says, Ptolemy's wrong. And he did, that's what he did for astronomy. And then he did something similar for terrestrial physics. He came up with precise measurements to determine whether balls rolling down a ramp accelerate or go at constant velocity. And by doing some simple measurements, he refuted Aristotle. And Aristotle's view had been considered to be absolute truth for about 1,800 years. That balls just naturally go at constant velocity. Except for, no, they don't. And then, of course, big heavy objects fall faster than little light objects. He did do that. He did drop the big and the small off the Tower of Pisa. It's actually a true story. And Aristotle was wrong again. 1,800 years wrong. And he just dropped balls off. But he did it very carefully. And so it was the observation that there was no point in debating it. You can debate Aristotle for 1,800 years and never get the right answer. Or you can drop a couple of balls off the Tower of Pisa and get the right answer in about a second. So this is what Galileo introduced. This is why he was the first great scientist. The whole package. He invented his own technology. He was a mathematician, careful observer, experimenter, put it all together. And this is what we don't have for the mind. People like Heidi and her mentor up in Finland, I think, making some significant strides here. It's very rare in the cognitive sciences to be taking first-person experience as seriously as her mentor and a few other people, because almost all of the studies of meditation, even meditation going on right now, are just objective measures. They're checking blood pressure and depression and insomnia and well-being, and they're looking at it, really these kind of, and well-being, because somebody says so. They write, I'm feeling better. Okay, then we statistically analyze what they say. That's incredibly crude science, frankly. I mean, somebody says, I feel better, and that's not going to be a datum. What does that mean? They think they're feeling better. So what? Maybe they just smoked some dope, you know, and didn't tell you. And so it was introducing the empiricism that moved natural philosophy into what we now call science. Because otherwise they'd still be debating Copernicus and Ptolemy and Tycho Brahe's theory, another theory that was another competing theory. We'd just be debating it indefinitely, just like philosophers debate everything nowadays when it comes to the mind. And they agree on nothing. They really don't agree on it. Because they don't have a telescope. And so they're debating and debating and debating. There was an article in the New York Times just a few days ago saying, where a philosopher was saying, don't ask philosophy to be relevant. It was a plea. Don't ask philosophy to be relevant. We're above that kind of thing. But do pay us our salaries. So introspection has been tried for a very short time, rather ineffectively, and from a Buddhist perspective, quite unprofessionally. This occurred from about 1880 until about 1910 when William James died. So introspection was being used in very, very primitive ways in different labs in Leipzig, Wilhelm Wundt, William James, Cambridge, Titchener up at Cornell University in New York. So it was being used somewhat, but one of the major problems was that the heads of the laboratories, these introspection laboratories, would tell people what they should probably be expecting to see. And lo and behold, the subjects wanted to please the professors, and so they started seeing just what the professors wanted them to see. And so then a professor over at Harvard wanted them to see one thing, and they saw that, and a professor at Cornell wanted them to see another thing and saw that, and in Leipzig they wanted. And so it wound up just being too much what in the law, I believe, is called leading the witness, right? So you just engineer it, and so you get the right answer, the one that you want to hear, right? And I think judges are very keen, my sense is that they try to look for that kind of thing to make sure it doesn't happen. And so for various reasons, that was one of the reasons, and then enormous external constraints from scientific materialism that said introspection has no place at all because we just study objective things. It collapsed, and it really has not been resurrected. It really hasn't been resurrected almost at all. But one thing, it was never put into the mix in the scientific study of the mind from a first-person perspective. Never. not in the history of Western civilization, as far as I know, unless we go back to late medieval period, perhaps, back to Pythagoras, back to the Desert Fathers. And that is before you try to investigate the nature of your soul, the nature of consciousness, the nature of your mind, from a first-person perspective. Train your attention. Train your attention. And here Padmasambhava says it in one paragraph. What happens if you don't train your attention when you're trying to investigate the nature of the mind, the nature of consciousness? You don't see it clearly. Just like you don't see the reflections in a pool of water, if it's filled with silt, if it's dirty, or if it's waves, you just don't see it. And likewise, you do not penetrate beyond just the surface level, what I call the pond scum of the mind. You don't get beyond just the ripples of the coarse mind unless you train your attention. And that's never been done. Not scientifically. And it still isn't being done. So in the Shamatha Project, these wonderful scientists, wonderful group of people, they're studying what the meditators did. But they're not doing it themselves. They're just observing the meditators objectively, quantifiably, physically. And I've not read one scientific paper yet that engages with the question, might the meditators be making significant discoveries in a replicable fashion about the nature of the mind that we are not making by using external objective measures? I've not seen one paper. Not one. And so this concerned me when I was a graduate student at Stanford 20 years ago. And that is, I was speaking with various people in religious studies and saying, you know, it would be really significant to introduce in our field, religious studies, that there are alternative ways of knowing, not only the scientific, but there are contemplative ways of knowing. And the Christians have a very rich tradition. The Kabbalah has a rich tradition. The Taoists, the Hindus, the Buddhists, and so the Sufis, and so forth. And we should be, as people whose professional discipline is religious studies, we should be letting the academic community know that there are more ways of knowing about the nature of reality than just scientific method, observing the physical, objective, quantifiable. And we should show that how this is complementary. That was like farting at a wedding. It was just not welcome. You know, like, what did you bring that up for? And they quietly escorted me out. You know, they gave me a PhD on the way out, you know. And just a couple of years ago, I was a principal organizer for a Mind and Life meeting, focusing on attention and first-person experience of consciousness and metacognition. And most of the speakers were scientists talking about brain studies and EEG studies and psychological studies and so forth and so on. And I got in there and I gave my presentation about how shamatha makes first-person perspective of investigating the nature of mind and making authentic discoveries in the nature of consciousness and mind really viable with the technology of shamatha. It was like farting at a wedding, except for all the guests on one side of the room, you know, the wife's side. They all totally got it. Gyawa Kamapu was there. I think Tsuknir Rinpoche was there. Sogyal Rinpoche was there. Of course, His Holiness was there. And they were giving me all kinds of praise. Alan, great. You're a great shamatha teacher. This is really fantastic. And then the other side of the aisle. Is he finished yet? Lead balloon. It was a lead balloon. It went nowhere. It was nowhere. Don't want to hear this, doesn't make sense, don't understand it, don't want to understand it, when is he going to stop? And that's pretty much the message I got. When are you going to stop? So the day after I gave my talk, I didn't say a word. We had a whole day of conference, I didn't say a word. I said, oh. Disappointment. So I don't think this is unreasonable, what Padmasambhava here is stating. And he's addressing here, 1,200 years ago, problems that have not been resolved in current scientific study of the mind. And that is, can attention be refined to exceptionally high degrees? The answer is absolutely do not know scientifically. Just don't know. The measures are very, very primitive. Acknowledge. I mean, they acknowledge they're primitive, but they're really, really primitive. Compared to stage 6, 7, 8, 9, achieving shamatha, let alone the jhanas, forget about it. You know, they're way down there at stage 1 and 2. If a person gets to stage 2, that's like, wow. let's write a paper. And they have. Actually, they have. Right. And so can attention be trained at all? Padmasambhava says, yeah, you have to achieve shamatha. Can we gain valid, accurate, stable, refined, replicable observations, like Galileo through his telescope, observing the nature of the mind, events that are arising in it, multiple dimensions of the mind? Yes, if you develop shamatha, that's your telescope. But what about this criticism that was leveled against the introspectionist? And that is, you're always leading the witness. They're just seeing what you told them to see. It's just a form of indoctrination, brainwashing. And Padmasambhava says, yeah, I'm addressing that too. Develop a meditative state first, be introduced to the view second. In other words, get clarity, get stability, settle your mind, and then introduce the theories so you can put them to the test of experience. Whereas if you've been trained for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years before you even start meditating, man, that's pretty heavy indoctrination. So, we now come to the instruction itself. He says, do this for one day. And so we have one day. And I want to front load this. And so this won't take long. It's a short paragraph. But I invite you to listen carefully, because what I'll read now, which is the third and final paragraph here, is what I invite you to bring into your meditation, which will be silent. Okay? So he says, position your body with the seven attributes like before. So the seven attributes, and this is sitting in the basically cross-legged position, and I won't give the full seven attributes, but it's sitting like many of you have been. Your posture is fine. And if that's very uncomfortable, then go into the supine position, as long as you're not getting dull. That's it. So, position yourself. Find a comfortable position. Okay? There it is. Position your body with the seven attributes like before. Steadily fix your gaze in the space in front of you, into the intervening space at the level of the tip of your nose, right here, without any disorderliness or duplicity. Nothing tricky, nothing fuzzy, nothing crooked. Just straight, clear, to the point. Boom. He gives some background here, and then he goes right back to the instruction. Thus, so far, so good, yeah? Just direct your awareness into the space in front of you. Just straight, clear, no elaboration. No distortion. Thus, while steadily maintaining the gaze, so your eyes clearly must be open, and he gives a whole account, background information, why that should be the case. While steadily maintaining the gaze, place the awareness unwaveringly. And this, of course, assumes you've achieved shamatha. Otherwise, you're not going to be unwavering. Place your awareness unwaveringly, steadily, clearly, there's the vividness, nakedly, there's in the seen let there be just seen, and the heard just as heard, and so forth, nakedly, without the conceptual overlays, nakedly, and fixedly, so again, really strong stability, without having anything on which to meditate. So you remember this in the last practice, just resting there, be totally present, but without targeting any object of the mind. Place your awareness in the sphere of space. So there you go. You've done that before. Okay, so this is now, oh yeah, I remember that. So far, similar. When stability increases, so there it is, you know what that means. When stability increases, examine the consciousness that is stable. So at the beginning, when you're just sitting down, you might just, you know, a little bit of like that, consciousness moving, attention moving about a little bit, but then you settle, your consciousness, your awareness stabilizes, boom. Note the phrasing, your consciousness stabilizes. We all know what that means. Or do we? And now we begin vipassana. What is it that just stabilized? It was moving about. It might have been a bit distracted. It might have been looking at this and thinking of this and how long shall I meditate and bop, 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 bop. It's going here and here and here. And then it stabilizes. Your mind stabilizes. Good. What is it that just stabilized? That's a noun. Your mind just stabilized. What is the referent of the word mind? Your consciousness stabilized. What's the referent of the word consciousness? What stabilized? When stability increases, examine the consciousness that is stable. So you're really paying close attention, like Galileo taking a really close look at Jupiter. And then gently release and relax. Okay? So he's not using the word inversion and contraction. He's just saying, really focus in, and then gently release and relax. Again, place it, your attention, steadily. So again, this convergence, this focusing, this concentration. Again, place it steadily and steadfastly. Now we're talking about continuity, which implies you've already achieved stability. Steadfastly, observe the consciousness of that moment, that consciousness that is stabilized. Observe it. What is the nature of that mind? We're going to use mind and consciousness synonymously here. What is the nature of that consciousness of the present moment that has become stable? What is the nature of that mind? The mind has become stable. The mind has become focused. What is the referent of the word mind? Let it, the mind, steadfastly observe itself. Steadfastly observe itself. The telescope mounted on the tripod, keeping fixed on the planet, the star, what have you. There's no debate here. There's no talking here. It's just radical empiricism. Let it, the mind, steadfastly observe itself. So far, this is shamatha, isn't it? Because shamatha is simply a placement of awareness. So far, until the next sentence. Now he starts posing questions. Is it, this mind, this consciousness, is it something clear and steady? Clear also has a connotation of luminous, bright. And steady? Steady has a connotation of still. Is it, consciousness, the mind, is it luminous and still? Is that the case? He's not saying it should be. He's not saying that's the right answer. He's saying, is that your experience? This mind, is it clear and steady, luminous and still? Or is it an emptiness that is nothing? That is, when you look for it, not finding. I'm looking for the mind that stabilized. I'm looking for the mind that got concentrated, and I'm coming up with nothing. Is that the case? Which? Is it luminous and still, clear and steady? Or is it an emptiness, a vacuity, a void that is nothing, a sheer absence? Is there something there to recognize? That is, when you're looking for the referent of the word mind, is there something to recognize? Question. Look again and again. And now we go into full Vipassana territory. He says, look again and again. Examine again and again. And then he says, and describe for me an experience. Now that's Vipassana. We never encountered that one in the shamatha teachings. He said, just do this. Look for the observer. Okay? Look for the agent. Okay? Good. Go up. Go down. Right. You know, give me 20. Push-ups, whatever. You know. He's just saying, doing it. Just do it. Stabilize. The whole point is to settle your mind in its natural state. But now he's assuming you've already done that. And now he's saying that now that you're now turning your whole interest right in upon the nature of the mind that is concentrated, saying, what do you perceive? And he's asking for an articulation. He's not alone here. I've seen this in other texts as well. They thrill me, frankly. When he says, describe for me an experience, look again and again and describe for me an experience. This is what scientists have been doing for 400 years. They look very carefully, Galileo looking very carefully, and he said, I see what can only be understood as planets. There's no other, not planets, moons. I see these little dots and they are moving around over a long exposure, because otherwise you just see little dots by a bigger dot. But long exposure by sustained observation, I see little dots moving around the bigger dot. Those have to be moons moving around Jupiter. There's no other rational explanation. And therefore, Aristotle, you got another one wrong. Because Aristotle said everything moves in circles around the Earth. Everything. The sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, everything moves around a circle. No, they don't. The moons of Jupiter move around Jupiter. They don't move in circles around the Earth. Got that one wrong. 1800 years, everybody not looking, just debating and talking and talking and talking. And then Galileo sees in a matter of days that 1,800 years of belief was false. So look and then be prepared to describe what you saw. This is Vipassana. This is Zen at its crystal sharp strength. When the qualified realized Roshi then gives his students some meditative object, some practice, some koan. It says, here's the koan. Meditate on this and report back. And then there's a dialogue. And then the Roshi, if very accomplished, says, gives them more. Okay, go back. Check again. Now look this. Or maybe gives them a new koan. And then come back. And so it's dialogical. It's going, if it's a really accomplished yogi and a really qualified student, deeper and deeper and deeper. Through investigation and dialogue. Investigation and dialogue. Where the Roshi is there to deepen and deepen. And I've known about that for a long time, although I'm not at all trained in Zen at all. But when I first encountered this in the Mahamudra and Dzogchen tradition, I was really thrilled. I really was. I had not seen this so clearly in the Gelugpa tradition. But it's so cool. It's so empirical. But it's demanding of us that we look very carefully and not just, you know, like that with blank mind or just like that, but look with intelligence, with discernment, and being prepared that you're going to be facing your meditation master in an hour or a day or 3 days, and your meditation master is going to ask you, what did you see? What did you see? And if you say, nothing, you say, well, go back and look again. You know, what have you been doing in the last 3 days? You saw nothing? Give me a break. Go back and look more closely, you knucklehead. You know. Nothing? God. You spent 3 days coming up with nothing? Try to do a little bit better than that. And then it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. So this is Vipassana territory. Look again and again and describe for me an experience. Describe what you see. Don't be afraid that you saw the wrong thing. Describe what you see. And you see, not leading the witness. Really, not leading the witness at all, is he? He's saying, is it clear and luminous? Is it luminous and still? Is it a vacuity? He's not saying, the right answer is. He's just saying, check, see for yourself. And then just tell me what you saw. Tell me what you experienced. Just tell me. And I'll be here to lead you deeper. So it is leading the witness in the sense of leading the witness to liberation. Not just getting some right answer at the end of the book. And this is, again, a tremendous power of the tradition. It's not just to gain some insights that you can write one more Buddhist paper about what you discovered when you studied the mind and get a lot of applause by other meditators. Oh, you got the right answer too, huh? Good for you, good for you. The whole idea is it's insight for the sake of liberation, insight to purify the mind, insight to find genuine happiness. So in this way, it's right on the cusp between science and technology. How do you know if you're trying to develop a laser? How do you know when you succeeded? When it works. Not when you have a really cool design or write a great paper about how to make a laser. You've succeeded when it works. Shamatha, you've succeeded when it works. Vipassana, it succeeded when it radically purifies your mental afflictions due to insight and nature of the mind. That's where the rubber really hits the road. That's the pragmatic value. So it's a complete fusion of an epistemic motivation to know reality as it is with a completely pragmatic orientation to achieve liberation. And you bring the epistemic, the pursuit of knowledge, like two lenses of binoculars in on the same object. You make sure you... So not like that. Bring them in. We all know what it's like. So two, and yet it forms one circle when they're properly aligned. We all know this. And then you focus them. So two, and now, of course, you have three-dimensional vision. Two eyes makes really good for three-dimensional. And you're looking through the epistemic eye and you're looking through the pragmatic eye. All those teachings in Lamrim about developing renunciation bodhicitta, it's all pragmatic. But then it gets to Shamatha Vipassana, it's all epistemic. In the Lamrim, right? Renunciation, bodhicitta, shamatha, vipassana. The pragmatic for the sake of the epistemic to fulfill the pragmatic. And it's all one agenda. It's all one thoroughly integrated agenda. to know reality as it is in order to be liberated, in order to find truth-given joy, genuine happiness. So, I'm going to now read this paragraph. I did it step by step by step. Now we're about to go into the meditation. I'm going to read that final paragraph. Just read it right through. Attend closely, because I'm front-loading it, and then we'll have silent meditation. You ready? Okay. Position your body with the seven attributes like before. Steadily fix your gaze in the space in front of you, into the intervening space, at the level of the tip of your nose, without any disorderliness or duplicity. Thus, while steadily maintaining the gaze, place the awareness unwaveringly, steadily, clearly, nakedly, and fixedly, without having anything on which to meditate, I didn't say that earlier, without having anything on which to meditate, in the sphere of space. When stability increases, examine the consciousness that is stable, then gently release and relax. Again, place it steadily, and steadfastly observe the consciousness of that moment. What is the nature of that mind? Let it steadfastly observe itself. Is it something clear and steady? Or is it an emptiness, a vacuity, that is nothing? Is there something there to recognize? Look again and again, and describe for me an experience. Thus, engage in observing its nature. Do that for one day. We'll do it for one session, and it'll be in silence. The practice of vipassana entails inquiry, careful examination, precise observation, investigation. Until you break through to some insight, some clear seeing. At that point, let your awareness linger in that insight, sustained unwaveringly with the stability and vividness lent to your vipassana by your practice of shamatha. Probe the nature of your awareness until there's clarity, and then rest in that clear vision. Let's bring the session to a close. Two broad avenues of practice for shamatha. Shamatha with a sign, with shamatha without a sign. Shamatha with a sign is a very broad spectrum of attending to some object, an image of a Buddha, the acquired sign, a wide variety of objects that one may attend to, and if they are mental objects, you may achieve shamatha doing that. As in the case, the classic Indo-Tibetan practice of generating a mental image of the Buddha and achieving shamatha on that image, I believe it's Asanga that points out that once you've achieved shamatha and this dramatic shift in the prana in the body, the suppleness of the mind and all of that has occurred, and you've achieved shamatha, at that point, what do you do with that mental image that got you there? You release it. You just let it go. Now it's crystal clear. It's like as if you're looking at the Buddha three-dimensionally luminously, about as clear as if we look, as if you were looking with your eyes. So you've achieved it, and now just release it. But now, if you keep your attention right there, There was an image of the Buddha, incredibly clear, three-dimensional, luminous, precise, high resolution. And then you release it. What are you looking at? What are you looking at? Now that you've released the image, what are you looking at? Substrate. Yeah. Substrate. That's there. That's what's left. As in settling the mind in its natural state, you have a sign. What is the sign? Space of the mind, whatever events arise. What are you attending to when all the events have vanished and all your senses have imploded? Substrate. Same thing in Theravada practice. You're following you're using the vehicle of the acquired sign, focusing. The counterpart sign arises, but it's so subtle you'll almost certainly lose it very quickly. It vanishes right back into the form realm from which it emerged. And what are you attending to? Substrate. What are you attending with? Bhavanga. What are you knowing? Not much. Because you're just gazing into this vacuity. So this is why, this is now in my interpretation, I don't think it's a wild interpretation, why Padmasambhava, acknowledging right at the beginning that there are multiple strategies, multiple methods for achieving shamatha, and when experiment with different ones, that some people might, among people following his own instructions, some people may have gotten there to shamatha by way of shamatha with a sign, and then they release the sign and they're just gazing into the substrate. So in case they didn't achieve shamatha by way of shamatha without a sign, where you're focusing on awareness all the way through, and finally substrate consciousness is ascertaining substrate consciousness, in case that's not the route that got you finally to shamatha, then he does a little bit of remedial work. And that's where he says, basically a big overlap with the instructions of shamatha without a sign, what is that consciousness that is concentrating? What is that consciousness that is still, that is luminous and so forth? So, clear overlap. In the shamatha, overlapping into vipassana. Now it's vipassana, overlapping backwards, remedial, back into shamatha. To make sure you don't skip this. And what is he looking at here? Exactly what Penchen Losen Chukigyansen was talking about in his text. This is the great tutor of the fifth Dalai Lama. Classic, marvelous Gelupa teachings on shamatha without a sign. He teaches both. Settling the mind in its natural state, shamatha without a sign, just by different terminology. But it's there, right? So I know some of you have Gelupa Lamas. You can assure them this is not heretical. And Penchen Losen Chukigyansen, the Penchen Rinpoche, says, now what have you ascertained when you have now achieved shamatha? By just focusing in upon awareness of awareness. What have you ascertained? What do you know now? What is your object? Now you've inverted awareness in upon itself. And you're seeing its clear, luminous, cognizant nature. You're seeing, you're ascertaining, you are knowing the essential nature of consciousness. Are you ascertaining rikpa? No. Are you ascertaining the emptiness of the mind? No. You're ascertaining the conventional or relative nature of consciousness. And that's a big deal. And that's exactly what Padmasambhava is saying. That's exactly what Dujum Nyingma says, and so forth. And so that's what this first phase is. When he says revealing nature of awareness, it's not rikpa. It's certainly not emptiness. It's simply there is a phenomenon that we give, to which we give the name consciousness. Can you ascertain it and know it directly with experience? And that's what that first one is. In other words, you're getting your target. Because you know what vipassana is for. The Mahamudra tradition, the Madhyamaka tradition, Dzogchen tradition, what's Vipassana for? To realize emptiness. But you have to realize emptiness of something. You don't just go out and look for emptiness someplace. You don't just say, I'm going to meditate on emptiness. Oh, there it is. Emptiness of something. Form is empty. Emptiness is form. Right. It has to be empty. Emptiness relevant to something, not just in and of itself, unless you want to talk about emptiness of emptiness. And so, where he's going here is to ascertain the emptiness of consciousness itself. But that means you first have to get the target. If you want to realize the emptiness of an iPod, then you first have to ascertain iPod. Know exactly what is an iPod look like. How to identify it. How is it different from things that are not iPods? And so, oh, that's an iPod. Nope, iPhone. You old fogey that I am. Okay, iPhone, that's an iPhone. Got it. Old one. Embarrassingly old. Oh my goodness. It's a 3. It's not even a 3S. Embarrassing. Okay. But now I've seen it. Okay. And now that I've identified it, I'm holding it clearly in the palm of my hand. Now I may be begin to meditate on the empty nature, the lack of inherent nature of the iPhone. Right? Similarly with consciousness. First identify, get the target, and then probe. To see whether it's inherently real, whether it exists by its own characteristics independently of conceptual designation. Is it inherently existent or not? But first you have to get the target. And that's what that first phase was. Pretty cool. So as we conclude, I'm going to go a little bit into dinner. A little bit, not much. Padmasambhava states this so, with, to my mind, incredible depth, clarity, precision. It's so provocative. It's so enormously timely. This was an earth dharma, discovered by Kama Chakmet back in the 14th century. So it's 600 years old in terms of common circulation from the 8th century to the 14th century. So 600 years, buried, waiting for the time to be ripe, like a time capsule. But the teachings are attributed to Padmasambhava, and so enormously relevant to the 21st century. I think maybe more relevant now than ever before. And the stakes are so enormously high. That is, I think there's nothing there in those teachings that is unreasonable, that's silly, that's superstitious, that calls for blind belief, allegiance to some authority, blah, blah, blah. There's none of that there. And yet these teachings, this type of teaching has been translated, published dozens of times now by myself and other translators. Almost entirely ignored by the entire scientific community. Almost entirely. They want to know what the chemicals change in your body. They want to know what happens in the brain. As one of the leading neuroscientists in study of meditation said, not long ago, just a few years ago, the only way to understand meditation is by understanding the underlying neural mechanisms. Now that tells it all. That sentence right there, that tells it all. That is exactly telling where the battle lines are. Because it is something of a battle, and it's exactly the same type of battle, a big opinion coming up, as the battle between Galileo and the Roman Catholic Church. He was a devout Roman Catholic. One should never forget that. Devout Roman Catholic. True believer. Trained as a contemplative monk, for heaven's sakes, when he was a child and an adolescent. Tremendous faith. Deep faith in Jesus, the Gospels, his own church. And he was advocating something that other people had advocated. Nicholas of Cusa was a cardinal. He advocated that the earth is not the center. He never got in trouble. Copernicus never got in trouble. A lot of people never got in trouble. Why did Galileo get in trouble? Because he had a telescope? There were many monks and priests that loved to look through telescopes. They were very keen on corroborating his observations. It was not a battle. Lots of clergy were getting their own telescopes. Say, hey, cool, Galileo, way to go, dude. You know, they're making the same discoveries. So what was the problem? Why did they put him under house arrest? Why did he become the martyr for the scientific tradition in opposition to the evil church and evil religion? Big opinion coming up. It was turf war. It was massive, big time, monumental turf war. Because until Galileo, this is now 16th century, early 17th century, during that late medieval period, if you wanted to go for truth, if you wanted to know the nature of reality, you went to one place. There was a one-stop market. Here's where you go. You go to Roman Catholic Church. That's where Aquinas was. That's where Aquinas had drawn together the wisdom of Greek antiquity, Aristotle and so forth, totally fused it. This is late medieval. Totally fused whatever good, one can say a little bit exaggeration, not a whole lot, but the wisdom of the ancients of Greece integrated in this monumental construct of scholastic theology. And so now you had the best of the Greeks. You had the Catholic tradition, the apostolic tradition, all now in one synthetic vision that was complete with philosophy, its own internal science, its religion, and this is the nature of the universe, and we have the whole picture. We now have complete knowledge of the universe in all of the important aspects. We have it. Aquinas put it together for us, and it's done, and we own it, and we're in charge of it. And moreover, if you disagree, we may have to burn you at the stake, like Bruno, who said the space was infinite. Burn him. So, you know, we have a way of dealing with competition. And so there was one place to go for reality, and that's all of reality. The heavens, the earth, heaven and hell, angels and demons, everything. God, of course, Jesus, the whole. It's a complete system, and we are in charge of it. We own it, and we enforce it, and we insist, in Jews, look out. That this is the one truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And Galileo comes along, not just with his telescope, not just with his mathematics. But he said, we natural philosophers, we have ways of investigating reality that you clergy as clergy don't have. You have your texts, you have your mathematics, you have your apostolic tradition, you have your philosophies. But we natural philosophers, like me, we have empirical ways of investigating that you don't have. And his fundamental claim, and this is where he drew this, the line in the sand, is that if we natural philosophers, we astronomers and physicists, that's what we call them nowadays, if we find empirical evidence that contradicts what you believe, and you may have believed for a very long time about nature, reality, when it comes to the physical universe, the objective, the physical, and the quantifiable, you no longer have authority. If we have evidence that contradicts you, you're wrong. And we stand, in other words, there's the realm of the human soul, human subjective experience. There's a realm of the divine, angels and demons and God and the Holy Ghost and heaven and hell and all of that. There's the sacred realm, the divine. There's the subjective realm of the human spirit and soul. And then there's the objective, physical, quantifiable, the physical universe. And we natural philosophers, we are now taking one-third of the pie. And we are demanding, I am demanding, Galileo, I am demanding that we have authority and we trump you. You don't have. You can't just hold a council and say we're wrong. So sorry, but we can show you're wrong with empirical evidence. And the Roman Catholic Church said, screw that. Well, let's just rephrase that. Screw you. Go to your room and stay there for the rest of your life. It wasn't just a little thing about which goes around which. It was one-third of the pie. And just saying, we're taking it. If we can show empirically that you're wrong, then you are wrong. And it doesn't matter how many Vatican councils, bishop councils, and so forth you hold, you're still wrong, and it doesn't matter what you say, because we're right. And they say, screw you. House arrest. Stakes were very high. Power and money and prestige. Power, money, prestige. Enormous in all three categories. And he's just saying, this one guy, this professor from the University of Padua, is saying, we just want one-third of your power, your prestige, and your money, thanks. If you don't mind. In the 20th century, much more than any preceding century, science is now, the whole scientific community has accumulated to itself, with good reason, enormous power, enormous prestige, and vast amounts of money. 19th century science was cheap. Darwin, he did it on his own. He paid for it. He was coming from a rich family. I don't think he ever got a grant. I think it was just his dad paid for it. His family paid for it. Darwin, revolution in biology. Did it on his own. Hopped onto the Beagle, you know. Went to Australia and so forth. 20th century, nobody funds themselves. Not for good science. Too expensive. And they're demanding the whole of nature. Once again, number one, they chuck out the divine and said, that's just superstition, so you can have it. Theologians, have a nice day. Over in religious studies department, you get that. It's crap anyway, so keep it. Keep it to yourself. And now, since the time of the late 19th century, the whole subjective realm, emotions, consciousness, perceptions, the human soul, human identity, has been appropriated. It's a land grab. It's a Louisiana purchase. The objective, the quantifiable, the physical scientists have just said, we may not be able to observe it, we may not be able to measure it, but we're taking it anyway. And we're going to just say it's the same as what we can measure. And if you don't like it, you can just shut up. Mind is just the brain. Mind is nothing more than brain function. meditation is not more than brain function. You want to know meditation, you don't need to meditate. That's why we scientists don't meditate. We just need to study brain function. Because meditation, after all, is just brain function. So we're just taking it. We're just taking it. And we're going to take the authority for it. And we're going to get all the money for researching meditation. And we're going to look at it physically, quantifiably, and objectively. And then when discoveries are made, it's going to be the scientists who get up there and will say, we made the discovery. The meditators were our subjects, and we made the discovery. And they'll take all the credit every single time. They've appropriated. They're now appropriating meditation as they appropriated consciousness, the mind. They're appropriating genuine happiness. They've already done that. And already said, oh, those old people in Buddhism, they didn't really get it right. But now, in the last 10 years, we've learned more about authentic happiness than the Buddhists ever did for 2,500 years. Stupid them. But we're scientists, after all, and we have a franchise on reality. So there's a turf war here. And the stakes are enormously high. The money involved, the prestige and power involved, is gargantuan. So His Holiness is usually, in His terms of His public addresses, and in so many meetings with Minor Life, He's sitting there as a student, listening to the geneticists and the biologists and the chemists and the physicists and mathematicians and so forth coming and displaying their goods. And He listens with such inquisitiveness, such incredible humility. And then sometimes He just says what's on His mind. And He did this in Santa Barbara a couple of years back. He said, when it comes to the physical world, we Buddhists have so much to learn from science. We really, you've gained so much strides, so much progress. We have much to learn from you. When it comes to the mind, you people are still in kindergarten. Doesn't say that so often, but that's a direct quote. So what He's saying there is when it comes to the physical and the objective, you scientists, you can have it. But when it comes to the subjective, the nature of the mind, the nature of genuine happiness, nature of consciousness, origins of consciousness, potentials of consciousness, if we have empirical evidence that the practice of meditation will refute you, and whatever you say doesn't matter, because you don't have the tools. You're just studying it from outside. You're looking at the dead skin, and we're looking at the living phenomenon of consciousness. And we trump you. Sound familiar? So I'm going to speak very briefly to people listening on podcasts. If Galileo just simply written a lot of books about what his beliefs were, because he already believed in the Copernican theory before he made his discoveries, if he just wrote one tract after another about Copernicus, it was much, so much more compelling, and the mathematics was more elegant, and so forth and so on, he would be forgotten, completely forgotten. Nobody cared. Because then it was just his book, and then other people would refute his book, and he'd write a counter-refutal, and then it'd be another refutal, and they all die. And the next generation come along, and they would write a whole bunch of philosophical books back and forth, and all refute each other, never agree on anything. In other words, they would be philosophers. So it wasn't enough to come up with compelling arguments. He had to get his telescope out there. He had to get his other instruments of measurement to make precise measurements. He had to do them, come up with unequivocal results that could be replicated by other people. And he started the scientific revolution. Copernicus was a prelude. If there are truths in what we've been investigating and in the method, and if there's validity to the methods we've been employing over the last 7 weeks, it's not enough to write another book. I've written a bunch of books by now, one after another, showing the profound limitations of scientific materialism, limitations of science as a whole when it comes to understanding nature of consciousness. As I said before, it's like flying at 35,000 feet, throwing a pebble out the window and seeing what kind of waves it makes down below. Almost no impact. Almost not. I mean, a few Dharma people, yeah, but... Oh. A person comes out with a new book about how they're making great insights into meditation because if they found this part of the brain is activated and that kind of... Big splash. Because that's where the money is, and the media is absolutely citing, unequivocally, without question. They're completely jumping onto the bandwagon. That science is the only way. Just like 400 years ago, the church has the only way. Now it's scientific materialism, the scientific method, the objective, the quantifiable, and so forth. It's the only way. University systems almost entirely are focusing on this is the only way. Religious studies That's for people who are interested in religion as an object of study. Study it scientifically to understand why these peculiar people thought as they did. I taught in religious studies. I had a conversation with a man who was an expert on Christian mysticism, very knowledgeable. And I asked him, as he was, because I was fascinated by the literature, I said, how do you think these Christian mystics came up with these conclusions? Because they're drawing deep conclusions. What kind of experiences do you think are their accounts based on? And he looked at me as if I'd farted at a wedding. And he said, we don't ask those questions. And it was clearly, it was offensive on my part to even raise the issue. We study the text here. What are you? I thought you were an academic. I thought you had a PhD from Stanford. We don't ask those kind of questions. We just read the text, and we write texts about their texts. So, people listening to podcasts, I'm very glad that Santa Barbara Institute has been able to, with the help of Lissy and the technology and so forth, our staff back in Santa Barbara, to offer all these podcasts to you for free. We'll continue to do so in the future. If you believe there's value in these practices and these discussions, I would invite you to do something significant, and that is for these types of methods and the discoveries that may be drawn from these methods to have an impact that is beneficial, to really help. There have to be observatories. There have to be laboratories. No technology, no Galileo. Just one more mathematician. Science has progressed over the last 400 years with laboratories and with funding graduate students, funding research, especially in the 20th century, exponential growth of knowledge, exponential growth of money being devoted to science, which is a good thing. I love science, just not that crazy about the dogmatism that goes with it. And this we have the only way attitude, which sickens me from the time I was a kid, both in religion and science, I don't care where it is. And so here is the next step, to create observatories that are specifically designed to help people develop the technology. Let's call it a contemplative laboratory to develop that technology of shamatha, however long it takes, 1 year, 2 years, however long, until people are getting the job done. They're building the laser of the mind. There's the laboratory, and then once the instruments are developed, instrument of shamatha, then the contemplative observatory to explore the nature of the mind and its relationship with nature and utterly revolutionize modern scientific understanding of the mind and its role of nature. But there have to be observatories. If all we have is more Dharma books coming out from me or the Dalai Lama or anybody else, spitting into the wind, it has almost no impact. Really, it really doesn't. The media are utterly dominating this with just absolutely kowtowing to scientific materialism having the answers to everything. You know, everything has to fit into that framework. And so it's complete dogmatism under the guise of science, which is tragic because science was supposed to be the antidote to dogmatism. And now it's like a rat carrying the flea of dogmatism. Sad. Because it betrays the very spirit of science, which is question even your most cherished assumptions, be open to new methodologies appropriate to that which you're seeking to investigate. So people listening by podcast, if you find this is valuable, I would encourage you to contribute. It can be to the Santa Barbara Institute, to create an observatory, which we are now very intent on doing. Casa Tibet, Mexico, especially if you're Spanish-speaking. Fantastic. They have the effort, they have the land, they don't have the money. Create an observatory there. And people from all over the world can come to Mexico because they have rather light visa restrictions, so you can stay there long term. It's an enormous boom. So contribute. If you don't believe in this, no problem. Why should you contribute? Contribute is something you value. But if you value this, back it. Let us create observatories with open-minded, rigorous, focused attention to develop that technology of shamatha and apply the science of vipassana and rock the world. Create observatories, but of course that's not enough. As we have young people, middle-aged people, whatever age, coming in, not all of them have the financial wherewithal to spend weeks, months, years in retreat. As Galileo spent weeks, months, years in research, so did Darwin and so did all the great other scientists. They didn't do weekend retreats. They didn't just do 8-week retreats and then come up with great scientific revolutions. It was years and years of research. Likewise, contemplatively, there must be people devoting years, if not decades, to investigating the mind, developing the tools, and making discoveries. And so help them as we sponsor, we support undergraduate students, graduate students in the sciences, and with good reason. I applaud it. I love science. We should be supporting young science students. It's a wonderful thing. And it's equally wonderful to support, for much less money, aspiring contemplatives who want to really fathom the nature of consciousness. So support them. We have a fund in the Santa Barbara Institute, small and dwindling, to simply provide scholarships for people going into full-time retreat to achieve shamatha and follow the path. And I'd love for that to be replenished so we can support more. So that's my request, especially to those listening to podcast. If you believe this has value, please support it. If you don't, then no problem. Support that which you do think has value. There's really a potential revolution here. And it's not just rhetoric. It's not light words. It goes right to the core of who we are, our identity, who we are as human beings. What is the nature of the mind? What's the potential of the mind? What is our potential for freedom, for happiness? This is a revolution that could dwarf that of Galileo, because it goes deeper. But it's a revolution for which there will be, has been, there is, and there will be mighty resistance. Because whatever is taken from the contemplatives, somebody's going to feel it's taking away from them. And that's money, and it's prestige, and it's power. And there it is, the contemplatives, like myself, I don't need much money at all. I don't want any power, except for power over my mind. And prestige, I'm going to be dead. What dead people need prestige? So it's a kind of funny thing, that if you're really a contemplative, the power, the prestige, and the money really mean virtually nothing to you at all. And yet, for other people, it's like giving their lifeblood to give their money, their prestige, and their power. And all of this, in a way, is symbolized in this great confrontation between one simple Buddhist monk and the most populous and one of the richest countries and most powerful countries on the planet. And they're terrified of him. This one simple 75-year-old Buddhist monk, and they're terrified of him. They try to block him at every place. He tries to go to Mexico to teach Dharma. They try to get him no visa. He goes to Washington, D.C. Can't go to the White House. They're blocking him at every step. This 75-year-old monk, pacifist monk. And they're terrified of him. Why? These people have trillions of dollars. Massive military. Massive population. They intimidate the United States. They intimidate Europe. They intimidate South America. They intimidate Africa. We won't do trade with you. We won't do trade with you. Oh, please do trade with us. Please do trade, you know. They intimidate everybody with economics and military when they need to. And here's a person who intimidates them. A 75-year-old pacifist Buddhist monk. That's worth reflecting on. There's a turf war here. Which side is on the side of reality? Money, materialism, brute strength, bullying power, or a simple person of virtue? Support what you believe in. That's what I'm saying. Support what you believe in. Because the stakes are very high for every individual and for the planet. Hola, so. Enjoy your evening. I'll see you tomorrow.